I'm very happy to be here in person finally, because I gave a seminar on Zoom, but it's not the same, it's totally different. So I'm very happy. And I'm going to talk about the possibility to hunt lighter matter with quantum sensors or experiments that exploit some quantum mechanical properties. And that's something very different from what I've been doing in my research, because usually I wonder about puzzles in the standard model and I try to think of a motivated UV theory and see how this UV theory can accommodate this and try to find correlations that then I go to experiment and I can see if this is the UV or not. And this is, like, would be top or bottom. And this is very different because the philosophy is like, okay, we don't know, let's be agnostic of what dark matter is. Imagine that this allied to degree of freedom and it couples somehow with my standard model. So what can I learn from the experiments that we have or already or we can even propose? What can we learn from the parameter space? And that's something I did in collaboration with Yufeng Du, who is a grad student. She was visiting here for this tabletop school experiments that I was so jealous that I wish I could have come as well. Chris Pardo is a postdoc that was at JPL and now is also in Caltech. Jikun Wang is another postdoc, and Catherine, also all of them at Caltech. So you are very familiar probably with this slide that we don't know so much about dark matter. We know how it's distributed in the galaxy. We know its mean velocity in the galaxy, 220 kilometers per second. We know the relic density, but we don't know what's the mass. Like, it could be the de Broglie wavelength could be as large as the galaxy, and it could be as heavy as those few solar masses, and we don't have a clue where this is. So it's hard once we think of how to detect it, where to look at. But of course, there are some windows that are more motivated than others. You know, the wind miracle, for instance, just taking familiar things, familiar scales, familiar couplings. It turns out that if you do a back to the envelope calculation and just plug like the cross section with a Fermi weak couplings and weak masses, you get something in the order of what you observe. So that was why people were excited about WIMPs, and has been a lot of effort in the literature and also experimentally to look for this data detection cross section, which looks tiny, but already the experiments we have, the traditional WIMP experiments, are doing way better than this. So they are accessing couplings that are lighter and lighter than the weak couplings. And actually, they are already touching almost this neutrino fog. That means that they are not background free anymore. They will become like neutrino experiments as well, because they are sensitive to the neutrinos. And then if you wonder what's this shape and how the sensitivity scales, because we are assuming that the density of dark matter in the Milky Way is constant, the heavier the mass, the less number of particles you have interacting, so you lose some sensitivity. And then there's a sharp cutoff in here for light masses that comes from the energy resolution of your detectors. So for instance, for nuclear recoil, you know that given a mass, there's a maximum momentum you can transfer, because the velocity at most is going to be the escape velocity in the galaxy, 550 kilometers per second. So this will transfer some momentum, and then the recoil energy will be also given by the target mass. If you take protons and nucleons, it would be like GV. So this, given that the energy resolution of nuclear recoil is something like KV, this sets up a lower bound around the GV. So if you want to overcome this, you need to change the methodology. So instead of using nuclear recoils, you could think of, for instance, changing the target, electron recoils, which their ionization energy allows you to lower this threshold of detection energy. And there are some also through semiconductors. And you can also change degrees of freedom, go to something like collective excitations, phonons, magnons, that allow you to lower this a little bit more. And even if you think of absorption instead of scattering, you can really map the dark matter mass with the threshold energy of your detector, so you could even lower this bound. But I'm going to talk about atom interferometers as a possibility to detect lighter matter. And then I think, because we will look at a quantum mechanical effect, which is the coherence of the wave packets, the two arms that are like two wave packets separated by a macroscopical distance, then you will see that there's no minimum energy deposition. There's a momentum, which is the best for sensitivity, that we will see what it is. But then when you go even to momentums that are smaller, means larger wavelengths, still you can be sensitive to a phase shift and to a little bit amount of decoherence. And this works for lidar matter and light mediators. And you will see that we can cover the range, but you will also see what are the implications or which kind of UV completions we can constrain. And you'll see that, well, you will see what happens. So this is something we did. We put an archive like already 5-6 months ago. And that's the original idea was proposed by Jess Riddle, who is working in MACRO. It's one of the atom interferometer proposals on space. He proposed that in 2013. And also in 2017, they have a follow-up paper. So what we did was taking this language, which because we were interested in studying space interferometers, because our colleague Chris works at JPL, and they have the Cold Atom Laboratory already working. And they are going to launch an improvement, which is called BECAL. It's the Bose-Einstein Condensate Cold Atom Laboratory. And there's also a GDM proposal that they will be better, and they will separate these wave packets by larger distances. And we were wondering what we can learn from it. So we took their language, and now we hope that it's more accessible. There's also a code online, so you can easily take your atom interferometer and map the five key ingredients and translate the constraints. And also, like, we studied the daily modulation, which can be important to discriminate dark matter from other sources. And we studied also the phase shift that dark matter can induce because it's isotropic and survives, and I will show you in a moment. The principle is very simple. It's like, well, simple at least in from the theory side. If you prepare your atoms in a ground state, all cooled to the ground state, and then you apply two lasers, so that the momentum of the difference of momenta of the frequency of these two lasers matches perfectly one of these definite transitions of this rubidium or whatever atom you're using, then this, if you act this laser for a while, depends on the time you apply it, you distribute your populations in a quantum mechanical way in this way, that's Rabi oscillation. So if you are pumping, the ground state will, the excited state will get populated until it saturates and it goes down, and there are some oscillations that are determined by this Rabi frequency. So the name of the pulse is really the argument of this cause up to a factor of 2. So pi half pulse means that the argument of this cosine sign is pi over 4. So you plug in here 1 over the square root of 2, and you are distributing your population in a ground and an excited state. Depends on how long you apply the laser. So this is really like a beam splitter. And then what happens is that these excited atoms, because they absorb some momentum, a definite momentum, which is the transition between these two states, and have some mass, they recoil with some velocity. And this will set, that's the distance time, they will travel with respect to the ones in the ground state, macroscopically, a distance that will be given by the time that they travel, and also the velocity that depends on the mass and the transition of the optical transition you use. And then if you apply another laser, this time at half of the time of your experiment, pi pulse, which means that you sweep the ground and the excited populations, because now you plug in the cosine and the sine and you do the rotation, you will see that they are inverted. So now this acts like a mirror. And these guys are the ones that travel and catch these other guys. You apply another beam splitter, another pi half pulse. Everything should be in the ground state, and you measure. So you expect to see if nothing else happened, is you are perfect system, and you put your lasers perfectly matching this energy, the frequency matching this energy, you expect to see a white port and a black port. And that's really like a Mach-Zehnder interferometer, where instead of light, there are waves of matter. Instead of using matter to beam split, you use light. So it's like the roles are inverted, but they are really mostly the same. You look at interference if there's something interacting. So these are two wave packets that are being separated macroscopically. And what can happen is that because there's some spatial separation between them, imagine that there's something that acts on one of these two arms. This something could be dark matter, could be a solar photon, could be dust, could be anything you have in the space or on Earth if your experiment is on Earth. Something that interacts with the right momentum, with momentum large enough to resolve these two clouds, it's resolving information from which path you are, and it acts by killing the quantumness of the system, meaning that these of the diagonal elements in the density matrix corresponding to this state, they stop being a pure system because this rate will have some real and some imaginary part. And then this is like the lifetime of the system being coherent. If this real part is large, you lose on this, you shrink this to zero. And if it's completely zero, you can see that this is like proportional to the diagonal. You can do as many rotations as you want. You will never be able to put it in a state where you have one and the rest zero. So it's not a pure state anymore. It will become a mixed state. So this is up to how many collisions you have and how strong these collisions decohere your system. And it can also shift on a phase. If it only shifts on a phase, you don't lose the coherence, the quantum mechanic behavior of the system. So this is parametrized in this four factor. Usually you can compute the rate of whatever object you have interacting with your nucleons, your wave packet. And then this coherent form factor is independent of the interactions. It weights the probability, so it weights the rate. And it depends on the momentum transferred and on the distance between these two clouds. It's like the Fourier transformation of the state of these two wave packets. And this depends on the directionality, so which is the angle, and also if it's, so intuitively, if you look at the real part that tells you the decoherence, this part here, what they call visibility or contrast. If you look at this real part, and there's nothing else on the ray that depends on the angle between delta x, the separation of the two clouds, and the momentum, you integrate this, you get a 1 minus a sinc function. So if the momentum is very small, you can see that this tends to zero, meaning that you don't decohere. It means that the wave packet is so large, sorry, the wavelength is so large that you don't resolve the clouds, so you don't get decoherence. But if the momentum is large enough that you resolve the clouds, you get full decoherence effect. So this is what people can measure. Well, also, you could look at the phase. The phase is the imaginary part, but you are integrating an odd function over an even window. This is zero, unless this is true for an isotropic source, no dependence of the angle in the rate. But if you have some kind of isotropy, and this can be understood because it's like if you average macroscopically over any possible shift in all the angles, you get zero. So there's no phase shift that survives. But if you have a directional source that comes in some directionality, like a dark matter wind on Earth, or in the orbits also it has some dependence with the velocity, in your Boltzmann distribution, you will get something that survives. And this something will be proportional to the speed of, in this case, the Earth against the dark matter wind, or if it's an orbit, then the speed of the orbit with respect to the dark matter wind. And this, that's for a small momentum, doesn't go to zero exactly. It has some dependence that we will use. And this doesn't happen for any other source that is isotropic. You don't get a shift that survives. So what they measure is the fringes. They get something like here. If you rotate this matrix, you will see that once you compute the probability, just phi, phi in the rho. Rho rotated once you apply the beam splitter, you get this probability in here. So it's if you don't have the coherence, it's 1. And then if you do have the coherence, you lose around the 1/2. So your probability shrinks. And you see, to see a fringe, you need several measurements, because one measurement only gives you a point. So if you want to resolve a phase, you want to resolve what's the max, the visibility or the amplitude of these fringes, you need to measure different, to change the phase on the lasers to see this, or do several measurements. And actually, they are doing it now with some interferometers. They do a gradient in the lasers. So with one shot, they can take a picture of a fringe. And that's like a very new technology they are developing. But otherwise, they need to do several measurements to see this information. Otherwise, you only get a point. So the effect, if you have the coherence, would be that these fringes shrink. And if you have a phase shift that is not the one by the lasers that you can control, you would see that this shifts. So that's, in principle, something you can measure. So if we want to see if this is caused by dark matter or by some other effect, we need to parameterize what's the loss in these fringes that they see, and also depends on how much time it runs their experiment to see how many measurements you could see. Depends on, because there's some time that the experiment takes data that it will, can be 1 year or can be months, and then there's some time that this system stays coherent, because it also it gets lost by it only survives that they can have it cool enough and they can have it in a coherent state for some time that usually is order seconds or below. So this will tell you how many measurements you have. And for this, what we did to parameterize the curves, we were talking to these people from JPL that they have the Cold Atom Laboratory. And we took this B background to be half of the fringe, which is pretty aggressive, because usually what they find just running the experiment and looking at the systematics of the experiment, they see like an 80% of the fringe. So we said, okay, if there's something extra apart from these systematic errors, let's take half of the fringe. But it could be dark matter, it could be a solar photon, it could be a solar neutrino. So we know from some papers that they study the cosmic rays, the constraints are, the effect of the coherence from cosmic rays is negligible. We don't know, solar photons might be more dangerous, but because there are a lot, but they couple through the nucleons through polarizability, which is suppressed. Solar neutrinos are, we also computed this already, that we are working on this, and they are also irrelevant. And we also want to parameterize dust. But in principle, this could help us to know if the any of these backgrounds is the consequence of this 80% that they see reduced compared to, or not just systematics of experiment.
Coherence can happen for all sorts of things.
Anything could cause the coherence if it.
Yeah, so then what is the control parameter to know that the signal?
So right now the experiments, at least this is, I guess it's also very experiment dependent, but if we take CAL, the Cold Atom Laboratory that is already running, they see some shrink in the visibility in the fringes. So they never see a full 100%.
That's why I'm asking. So it, how do you tell it apart that it's a dark matter? To discover, let's say there is, it's this coming from dark matter.
There's someone asking?
These are very exotic sources. There is a lot of residual gas.
But if you are in space, this is
not in space. This is
in space. Well, the ones that we were looking at are made.
But this is in the lab, right?
No. Well, we also study one that is in Stanford that is on a lab.
The data where you're saying 80%, this is in space?
In space.
It's already in space.
Yes, it's in the ISS, the International Space Station. Space station. So they see this decoherence because of the experiment itself, because the way they measure, there's some, maybe because of the finite size of the clouds, they are losing some kind of coherence when they make the clouds, the wave packets overlap. They see some loss of the coherence.
Outside in space.
So we expect that if there's some other source causing the coherence, will be larger than this. That's why we say 50% of the fringe with. Because also, if you don't see anything, probably is that your experiment is not working properly. So you need to see something to see that there's a phase shift, to see if there's daily modulation. But then it's very hard to say, this is dark matter. That's going to be very... It's very hard. It's very easy to rule out.
Yeah, that's...
But it's very hard to...
Signal.
It's very hard to distinguish and say, this is fully dark matter. So what we would need to do, if one of these experiments is something on space... Then they need to run it also on Earth, because it depends on the cross-section. If the cross-section is large, maybe it doesn't cross the atmosphere. Also look at daily modulation and see how the signal, the amplitude changes along the day, and run different checks. But I think it's very hard to say that this is, probably gives you a hint of a mass or some coupling that you can look in other ways.
Do you know about models? I guess you'll talk about models
later. I'll talk about models.
Okay.
And you'll see that it's tough.
What is the density naively, it's one atom per centimeter cube. That's very naively, right?
No. It's roughly, the pressure is like 10 orders of magnitude below.
She said it's outside.
Yeah,
It's outside.
Well, it's not density. Maybe there is some outgassing.
Yeah, we are parameterizing this. So we saw that, for instance, for solar neutrinos, the flux is not so good.
Solar neutrinos.
I was hoping that was giving something interesting, but I was seeing that all these experiments of neutrinos. And they have tones. And here we are talking about a cloud of 10 to the 10 seems a lot, but it's not tones. So, and solar photons, the problem is the luminosity is large, but the coupling to nucleons, is neutral nucleons, is so tiny. But it's also, it's hard to... Then you lose the atoms, but so when you...
The experiment, I think, with light. The sun shining.
But if you lose the if you lose the atoms, it will cause some decoherence. But depends on the momentum,
yeah.
I guess, and the strength of this coupling. So they lose some atoms. They have to constantly refill.
Yeah.
In, not in space. So they lose some atoms during every round. They lose some atoms on the cloud. They have to refill it every time that they do the measurement. But on Earth, they have shielding. And we didn't study on Earth experiments. So we took a proposal that was 2014 called Pino, that I will mention later. But then the referee told us, what about this fountain of 10 meters in Stanford? That is like the prototype of magic. And they are already running this thing. And we got very excited because we were more wondering about these space interferometers that will take maybe 5 years to be approved and sent. So the Becal will be sent soon, but the other ones are just like phase two advanced initiative proposals of NASA that are still not even approved. So very futuristic still. But this stands for experiment, and MAGIS will also probably run soon with a large, I don't know, like the numbers are good. I'll show you in a moment. Another thing you can look at is the phase. And the phase, these interferometers are accelerometers. So they look for modifications in the gradient of, they want to look for modifications of gravity, for modifications of the fine structure constant, and all this, if you have like light dark matter that can change it, you could be sensitive. And they have some minimum acceleration they can measure, which is given basically by the orbit they are, or every experiment has a minimum acceleration they can test. And this will tell you what's the minimum phase that you can aim to observe. So the rate, that's where your physics enter, your model enters. It will depend on some probability of interaction, the decoherence that decouple from the rate. So it weights the rate by this Q, by the transfer momentum and the separation, but then you plug here your particle physics information, and this depends on the number of events per target mass. So you have the density, if it's dark matter, the density of dark matter over the density of the target, then you have the Boltzmann distribution with the velocity, mean velocity and escape velocity, and in here you have the Fermi-Golden rule tells you what's the probability, that's your input, and the decoherence form factor that, as I was telling you, why it disappeared, it's like this 1 minus exponential, and depends on the momentum. So you can integrate the delta function, use it to integrate the Boltzmann distribution in an analytic function that is has a very nice shape, but it depends on exponentials and the velocity, and I will just write like g. And in here you put your particle physics input. So I'm going to assume scalar dark matter coupling to a scalar mediator coupling to nucleons in a very generic way that I have dimensionless couplings, but this is really because I want to make a generic evaluation of curves. So I will introduce this object here that is a constant, the reference cross section. And this thing is a trick that allows you to hide all the model dependency in here. And you can notice that it's not the correct cross section because otherwise you would have the momentum transferring here. But that's why I write this form factor of the mediator, that if it's a heavy mediator, this guy dominates and this is correct and you put a one in here and this thing goes out of the integral. But if it's light mediator, this doesn't matter, this guy matters, so you correct this average momentum and you put back the q square. So this thing stays in the integral, and this cross section, I will pull it out. So whatever cross section, whatever limits I give you, if you know what's the reference cross section, you can map it if you prefer to have spin one mediator or fermionic dark matter, whatever you want, you just map it in this cross section in here and you can translate the bounds easily. And this decoherence form factor, as I was telling you, if you resolve it to clouds, you get maximum decoherence. If not, it falls, but it falls with q squared, delta x squared. That's the limit of this 1 minus the sinc function for light momentum. It doesn't go to zero with a Heaviside function. It goes power law to zero with momentum. Then there's the target form factor, and this plays an important role in the sensitivity. This, again, depends on more distances. So we have the separation of the clouds, but also we have a radius of the clouds. And the cloud might have different atoms. And then if you resolve the cloud, so the two clouds, but you don't resolve one each of the clouds, then you can get an n squared enhancement from the number of atoms you have. And you just compute the Fourier transformation of this wave packet square, and for the atom is the Helmholtz factor. If you have a Bose-Einstein condensate, it's a bit different. And actually the referee was complaining about this, but it's if you assume a shallow potential, because they are created from shallow potentials, you can approximate it to be an harmonic oscillator with some radius. It's the Gaussian that solves the system. And then this just takes the Fourier transformation and behaves very closely to this, like almost a Heaviside function. So the importance in here is the distance of whatever you have. If you have a cloud, the radius of the cloud. If you have a Bose-Einstein condensate, the radius associated to the very shallow potential that you have. And this will give you some coherence if you don't resolve it. And same thing, if you resolve a cloud but you don't resolve each of the atoms, you also get a number of atoms enhancement in here. So this in total gives you at most an n squared at the end. So this n is the number of nucleons, and a times na, number of atoms times the number of nucleons in an atom, gives you the total number of nucleons in the cloud. And that can be up to 10 to the 10, 10 to the 8, depends on the experiment. So these are the key parameters: the time that the experiment runs, the radius of a cloud, the distance, the number of atoms, and the atomic atom of your... They usually use heavy atoms like rubidium, has 86 nucleons. So we were trying to guess what are these... This Becal is the one that they are working at JPL that will be sent next year or in 2 years. This is approved and they are already working on it on the labs. So they will send it to the ISS kind of soon. And they can separate things millimeter, which is not great, but they can keep 10 to the 8 photons of nucleons and run the experiment for 3 seconds without losing fully coherence. And then this is a more ambitious project. This is the one that is a phase 2, still has to be approved by NASA. But they want to separate things 25 meters. And I'm still amazed how they can macroscopically separate 25 meters, something that has a radius 1 millimeter. Point to point, that's in the, then the, yeah.
Then you have to have enough intensity to be far away, and you read it out, that's all you do.
You contaminate. Maybe the signals that they see in one interferometer come from another interferometer that won't launch in things. This can be...
The idea in space, there is no, everything is free, in free fall, right?
Yeah, but this GDM is, they think of having like a network of 6 interferometers, and I think it's very ambitious. We'll see if it's approved, but the separation, they will be sensitive, so the peak in the sensitivity will be for very light masses. So the way, yeah, that's a good question. This is the original aim for the experiment, why they can measure dark energy. Doesn't dark energy change?
Yeah, that's true.
It's just this. It doesn't matter, right?
Like Holometer at Fermilab was supposed to test holography, and I still don't understand what they were testing from.
Let's
all this.
US dollars.
Okay, so then we also studied this proposal that was just to see what would happen on Earth if it's very isolated, and because to study the daily modulation, we know what's the velocity. This depends on which orbits they are. The daily modulation will change. Actually, it can be very short. But in here, we just took this as an example, but then the referee told us about the fountain, the 10 meters fountain in Stanford, and you can see that does very well. So they have the same number of nucleons that this Becal on space. They can separate 0.1 meters, which is already like the orders of magnitude larger than the radius. And the coherent time lasts 2 seconds. So this is something I'm pretty amazed that they are doing right now. And that's... Huh? You saw the numbers?
Yeah, so they have...
Oh, really?
Yeah, at Stanford, I mean, Jason has done 50 centimeters.
Oh.
So, like the...
Well,
yeah.
I graduated, so...
Oh, yeah.
No, but we took this from...
Jason Hogan?
Yes. Yeah. I saw his talks, yeah.
But haven't you seen where he shows, like, this very nice thing you draw with the colors?
Uh-huh.
Like spikes, not just broad. It's like spikes separated by 50 meters.
Okay.
Really cool.
Well, then we have to update the number. It will get better.
It's just insane. It's...
Yeah, I think we got this number from a paper that it wasn't Jason involved. It was other people. And it's called Atom Interferometer Fountain. And
yeah.
But maybe it's a bit old.
Other stuff too. He's working also with
Jason. Okay, maybe it's an old number. And then
yeah,
Jason was...
Jason Hogan.
Okay.
He must have had it, like, even in his website. I would put it on, like...
on a poster. The office. Okay, okay. Ah, macro is this other proposal that at least there was a white paper this year where they update the numbers. Still, it's not very clear if it's approved or not, but at least they have a white paper and they run everything. Like all the details seems very advanced. So the CAL, the one with OBEC, CAL is working. BECAL will be working soon, and this thing is running. The fountain is running. But on space it's only CAL, and CAL is not that good, so the numbers are like less number of nucleons, and we didn't run it for CAL, but CAL is working, so it's an atom interferometer that is working, and that's what we get the feedback from these guys that are working on this, and they see this decoherence, and we use the numbers that they told us as a reference, but probably this will depend on every experiment will have their own. So their own systematics and their own loss of coherence just because of running it. So that's something that will depend. But you can take, so also the code that it's online, you can plug your visibility background, your noise, and then run it, and this can easily be changed. It's, in principle, this will change, depends on the experiment. So these are assuming the same background visibility for all of them, and the same the same statistical treatment as CAL is doing, then we get the sensitivity curves. That's the Stanford one is doing pretty well. So they do better for low masses, but I cut in here because of cosmological things, and I will explain you later if you want. But if you want to understand from the rate very naively what are the what is the scaling and why this forms, let's take some limits like zero mass, very very tiny dark matter. In that case, the momentum also goes to zero because the velocity at most is going to be the escape velocity. And then you can see that in this limit you won't resolve anything, so you get the n-square enhancement, but you lose on the ability of decohere, and actually you lose like q squared delta squared. And I don't put a zero because the q squared matters because everything is light, so you can see that there will also be an enhancement on the rate by the q.
2 to 2 like is still a good assumption here.
What is 2 to 2?
Assume you are dark matter and you are seeing.
If it's super light and it behaves like a classical amplitude. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, we won't go to that much. So we will cut it at 10 EVs.
10 EVs is still like...
Yeah. Yeah, it's 10 to the minus 3.
Particle spacing is small.
Yeah, that's a good point. We assumed point-like. So maybe for light, it's true that will start to behaving like a wave, and maybe we need to change the, but for kV or slightly below that, it's still fine, no?
At some point, if you scatter enough, then it becomes a refractive damage.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's a good point. So we'll check that. What happens in the limit of very, very light dark matter. Yeah, and here I was just thinking of like the usual scattering. And in that case, the rate would scale like mchi minus one, but if you don't cause coherence at all, so even if with large wavelength, then this would be zero. No, depends on if you can still decohere, and this goes like some one q squared and it's enhanced by the ray, but if it was exactly, strictly speaking, zero, you wouldn't get any signal. You could still aim for the phase shift, has some directionality, but then you wouldn't get any decoherence, any shrink on the visibility of these fringes. On the other hand, if the dark matter is extremely heavy, you resolve everything. Heavy meaning something like around a GV or a bit less than that, you resolve everything, so you don't get then an enhancement, but you get full decoherence. And then if you write what's the limit, you can see that the cross section in this case all scales with mchi. So in a logarithmic plot, this is the slope. And the way where they cut the y-axis depends on the experiment, so depends on the number of nucleons you have. And then if you want to find what's the best, the sweet spot of sensitivity, and you equate the one and the three limits, you will find that this is the case where your dark matter doesn't resolve one of the clouds, but it resolves the system of the two clouds. So you get the coherence and n-square enhancement. And in this case, you can see that the cross section goes like m chi cube. So that's why this is slope. And that's the point where if you equate 1 and 3, you find that the mass of where this thing happened depends on the radius of the cloud and the distance of the clouds. And this R means the ratio between the mediator and the dark matter. So we are assuming that the mediator is always lighter than the dark matter in order to have the Q squared enhancement in the denominator. If not, it behaves like a heavy mediator. It's more suppressed, so it was suppressed by Q squared. And if you go to low momentums, you will have less and less decoherence. But yeah, we need to check. Thank you so much for the comment. I'll check what happens when they become wave dark matter, or you can deal with it as a classical source if this causes the coherence in the same way. But will you decohere if it's like a background?
I think there is still scattering always. But it depends now. You have to worry about it below. Maybe at the edge of your plot.
Yeah. Because in here, already the dark matter escapes the galaxy if it's too light. And you will see that so this area, the nice thing is that usually other experiments cannot go below KV, 10 KVs. And in principle, because in this quantum decoherence, you don't have a limitation on energy. Yeah, yeah, we are assuming. So we were assuming scalar dark matter also, because once you compute, you'll see in cosmology the ineffective matters. And then if it's better, if it's 1 degree of freedom rather than having a vector. But yeah, so there will be other constraints in here that are tough, just because it's light and the mediator is also light. And then there's the phase that are these discontinuous numbers in here that seems very good, but it seems constant. And you might see that, okay, this doesn't decouple if you go to very light masses or and this you don't need to decohere. You just need to cause a phase shift. But the thing is, once you get constraints on the Yukawa couplings and the masses, you can see how it decouples. So this is because of the way the cross section is defined. It seems that it's a constant limit, but it's actually not. Yes, you will. You will, and you'll see now. I'm just going there. So we have to face all these constraints. Now, this is very beautiful from the bottom up. No, like you have this experiment, and if this was this dark matter, you could constrain it, and it looks like you can do very well. But now you have to go to the real world and think, okay, let's see, let's put numbers. I put dark matter, let's put a mediator and see what's the cross section. And then you have, as Maxime was saying, you have self-interactions of nucleons mediated by this mediator. And if you compute the Yukawa potential, the range is large because this guy is very light. So it can be thought as a modification of the Newton potential. If you take these constraints here that look very naive, the Ressel constraints, you translate it with this mapping to the Yukawa N, which is the coupling between the mediator and the nucleons, and you see that it's very tough, especially for this, because we are assuming some ratio between the mediator and the dark matter. If the dark matter goes to very light, and you assume 10 to the minus 5, the mediator is even lighter. So depends on the ratio, we can map these constraints to the plots that I was showing you. And in the most optimistic case, in which the mass of the coupling of the dark matter with the nucleons, the mediator is almost non-perturbative. This is only the constraint on the Yukawa. So I'm basically assuming that in the cross section, if it goes like these guys, and this is the coupling between dark matter and the mediator, and this is the coupling of the mediator with nucleons, then I'm saying, okay, this is the largest I can have, and then I'm constraining this. And then the mass maps to, so if it's the mediator mass is constrained here, I map it to the dark matter mass that will show up also on the...
There's production of phi, on-shell production.
There we go. So yeah, so there are constraints too, which are a bit more model dependent, because it can be produced at red giants or horizontal brown stars, also supernova, which is a bit trickier because you have to modulate it. And that's why these constraints cut in here, because they can be reabsorbed if the scalar is mediated in the travel. They don't travel enough, so they absorbed again. And these constraints will also map in our plot and kill part of the parameter space. So now there's another constraint that is just dark matter interacting with itself, being light. And this is very, doesn't seem that harmful, but for lighter matter it is. That's what we do. That's what we have to do. So that's what we have to do. So this is from the Boalet cluster or from all the halos. You can constrain this. If you plot everything, you I mean, you can do very well with atom interferometers, but you can't find any UV completion that gives you anything interesting unless you assume a subcomponent. So unfortunately, these experiments will always only be able to test a subcomponent that can be like 5% you avoid this self-interaction. Dark matter constraints, also warm constraints, but it's tough. So the message is that these experiments, I wouldn't advise them to be built for dark matter, but since they are there anyways. So we need to see what we can learn from them. And if they can see if there's something, or at least they rule out some parameter spacing, we know there's no subcomponent such that small. I mean, neutrinos are also contributing to the Rayleigh density. We don't really know what dark matter is. So we can learn something, but it's, unless they do very well and with sensitivity, which is it's hard because they are already futuristic. It will be. Mm-hmm. Oh, space.
Have two different types of atomic clocks.
So atomic clocks, I was wondering because this.
You don't have to separate them. You just have to
come
specially separate.
Yeah, that's what.
The transmission of the signal to the ground is not that great. You have two different types of clocks.
No, but you can do it in a spectrometer. Because the laser takes some time.
I was not talking about it.
Yeah,
this is like the dumbest thing.
It would be nice if these things, the Cohen's counts, would be studied in atomic clocks. Or, yeah, I'm gonna run. So,
it's okay.
Yeah, it's so. You also have cosmological constraints, but this if. Or because of the stellar constraints are already tough, if the Yukawa is smaller than 10 to the minus 9, then you can compute that the mediator decouples from the gluon interaction that would bring it to thermal equilibrium before QCD phase transition. So this means that at most it will contribute to an effective like 0.06. And same thing for the dark matter because it's only coupled to the standard model bath with this mediator. And then maybe these experiments that will be sensitive to 0.04 or even like this, the ballpark of this degrees of freedom will be able to rule out the possibility at all of having this light mediator in dark matter. And yeah, so that's what we can see. And it's great that you don't have energy deposition. We need to understand in many ways what we could see also with these improvements on space, but it's a bit sad in the sense that you only are able to constrain a subcomponent. And then I wanted to say a few things also about ultralight dark matter, where you can, it's true that also for heavy dark matter, it's hard to connect it with the standard model because the freeze-out, just an IE freeze-out annihilation to contribution to the Rayleigh density, you need non-perturbative, you need another way to set up the Rayleigh density. But for light dark matter, you could still have ultralight. And for instance, axions, which are super motivated by solving the strong CP problem, thinking, they are just pseudo-scalars because the global symmetry Bechet-Quinn is broken by the color anomaly, the QCD instanton, so they will also get a mass. And it plays a twofold role because when it's relaxing towards the minimum, it behaves like non-relativistic dark matter and can contribute to the Rayleigh density. So it's motivated in a sense, maybe it doesn't exist. There's the action quality problem that I'm always very puzzled about. Depends if you like them and they can be completed in string theory, whatever, they could. There are ways to solve this action quality problem, so they could be a nice candidate. And also the cool thing is that if we are talking about the QCD action, the mass is inversely proportional to the Bechet-Quinn scale, and it's very cleanly predicted in the support of the C, so it's just the QCD scale, mu lambda QCD. So people have done a lot of effort trying to see this band, and these color things that I took from Sierra Nohare plots, ADMX is the only one that has seen something between 2.2, 4.7 microEVs. But these other experiments that are high-stack is almost about to touch the KSP set line. And there are many proposals that are in different frequency regions, maybe in 5-10 years, depends how the funding is distributed around the community and if it's fair or not distributed. We will see if the QCD line is, if the QCD is dark matter or not, at least. And it depends on the experiment, right? Because this looks at photons, but you see the coupling with gluons and it's not a haloscope, you might be able to see by other reasons, like what Christina was telling me about this super radiance, you would be able to test the axion not only if it's dark matter, not only a haloscope. So we will see. And I wanted to talk about a proposal that we were thinking, Catherine and Yikun, using optomechanics to track for a possible axion. So this optomechanics, just very standard, is like... Yeah, and I'm...
So you have at least
15 minutes. Okay, but I can do it earlier, actually. Yes, yes, because you will see, and I need feedback from you, but you can tell me later. Yeah, but I will finish, unfortunately, soon. So this is a cavity, Fabry-Perot cavity of length L, and then you can pump it with a laser, and there are some frequencies that are fortunate in the sense that the boundary conditions, they reflect and they form a standing wave, so they interact constructively. And these are multiples of this free spectral range, which is like pi over L. This is just having an integer number of half wavelengths inside your cavity. And if the laser is just in one of these frequencies, perfect, you have the full photons in there staying in these standing waves. If it's not, you will pay a price that I'll show you later, it's a tale of a Lorentzian. So if you fill this cavity with some material, and let's say superfluid helium, because I know some experimentalists that are doing this, and at Yale, we got inspired by listening to their talks, then there's an optomechanical coupling that comes, which is, it depends on the polarization of the material, the ability of forming dipoles and interact with light. So macroscopically, you can think of the laser, the light, causing some pressure, and the pressure changing the refractive index of the helium, and then helium interacting back with light. And microscopically, you can think of the helium as an harmonic oscillator. So if you write your electric fields as annihilation and creation operators of photons, and the density as creation and annihilation operators or acoustic excitations, which are phonons, this is the optomechanical coupling, is proportional polarizability times the normalization of the electric fields times some overlap factor that accounts for the momentum conservation in the cavity. Then you can see that the helium, it has just the waves that are formed in the material satisfy the same boundary conditions at the level of the wave length, but then the frequency, the acoustic, the resonant acoustic frequencies are weighted by this speed of sound, which in helium is 10 to the minus 6. It's like if you start with 1.5 micrometers, that is 200 terahertz frequency of your laser, you end up with some frequencies in the acoustic which are megahertz, 200 megahertz, so it's 10 to the 6 less. So if you look at this coupling here, you can destroy a photon from the pump and create a phonon. So the energy that the phonon takes will redshift your outgoing photon, your Stokes photon. So if you want to compute what's the amount of energy, you'd go to energy and momentum conservation. One-dimensional cavity, it's very easy to show that the photons will be back-to-back, and the phonon will take twice the momentum of the photon, meaning twice the frequency of the laser. And then you can compute this, you put the frequency of the laser, the speed of sound, and you know what's the energy that the phonon will carry, the frequency, so you know how much is redshifted, this photon. So that's why you will see some sideband that is called Stokes that is shifted from the pump by omega m, which is precisely the Brillouin frequency twice the optical times CS. Similarly, you have another term that you destroy a phonon and you blue shift a photon, and that's the other sideband that you get, and they are separated by the same frequency. Then the rate will be proportional to the optomechanical coupling, and because this guy is a coherent state in your Fermi-Goldens rule, you will see that you get an N enhancement from this N being the number of photons that are circulating in the cavity due to the pump. And if you want to compute this, you just think of light traveling and being reflected on the mirrors, because the mirrors are not perfect, you lose a little bit of this population, and then you can estimate, compute the lifetime. And if you plug the reflectivities in there, it depends on the length, how much you travel for one of these round trips, and you can compute what's the cavity loss. This cavity loss, or the inverse life, coherent lifetime of the photon in the cavity, depends on the speed of light, which is one, we're taking to be one, natural units, the length, and the fineness. The fineness is just up to a factor of pi. This tells you about the quality of the mirrors. So if they are very good and they reflect the photons very well, they can get up to 10 to the 6 fineness in these optical-mechanical cavities. So another difference from any other thing happening at free space is that when you, you increase the frequency, you have more density states available. But in the cavity, because of this lifetime, it enters in here, like something proportional to the lifetime, and then your density of states becomes a Lorentzian around each of the optical modes, meaning that the space shrinks, and this Lorentzian has a width given by the rate, by the loss rate of the cavity, or the lifetime of the photons inside the cavity. So if you want to know if you have the laser precisely in one of these optical modes, the number of circulating photons will depend on the power, the lifetime, and the frequency. And if it's shifted because you cannot put it on resonance, then you will pay a price, which is the tail of this Lorentzian, and depends on the width of the optical mode. So let's imagine that I'm clever enough and I put my pump in a frequency mode, so I get the maximum I can. So now, what happens? That's the transition that experimentalists have been studying, the Stokes transition, and that's what we were hearing about, and they are studying the lifetime of this guy, and because they have the phonons, the phonon lifetime dominating in here, and then they can compute this up to very good precision, and also they fit it to G0, and they study these properties, and in these papers in here, and other papers. What would happen if you have an axion interacting in here? So the axion is very peculiar in the sense that you need something that doesn't spoil your matching conditions. The axion is non-relativistic, the momentum is not gonna change. Still, the phonon will be twice, the wavelength of the phonon will be twice the optical wavelength, but it talks to photons. So you can think of any dark matter, but then it's hard if you think of a dark photon, something that couples to two photons, it's hard to make this diagram. So I've thought about it, and really axions are the only source I can imagine, but if you come up with something else, would be nice. But this, because axions have some mass, that with the mass what will do, if you look at the energy conservation and momentum conservation, although the momentum doesn't change, the axion mass will shift these Stokes, it will blue shift it by the axion mass, by energy conservation. So instead of seeing your peak here, you will see it in here, but very suppressed. That's because the coupling, if you were looking for the QCD axion, is very suppressed. So you can think of this interaction where the virtual photon carries a specific frequency, which is the frequency of the laser. And then if you compute the optomechanical interaction, it's very similar, but you have here the amplitude of the axion, that for the QCD axion is 10 to the minus 22. So you need to overcome this with some kind of enhancements, because otherwise you won't be able, even if this is shifted, you won't be able to resolve it with respect to the tails of the pump or... Yeah, so the axion frequency will be up to the width of the Boltzmann distribution, will be the mass. So what it will do is it will shift the sideband. Instead of seeing it at pump minus omega m, depends on the axion mass, if it's very small, it will stay here. If it's large, it will shift this peak. So if now, if you want to see the peak, you can do it in several ways. So we were thinking about having a probe laser that sweeps around frequencies where you don't expect to have the Stokes or anti-Stokes. And if you see some fluctuations on top of this probe laser, would come from the fact that you have an axion shift in the sideband. So there's the way to measure it would be scanning around a probe or using a filter and counting photons. So this, the challenge is that this is extremely suppressed. What? Yeah, you have still, which are the sidebands in here? So it's something that you know what it is. Are the Stokes and anti-Stokes? Oops, are there anyways? You will have the pump, you will have the Stokes, the anti-Stokes, and the axion peak if it's there. And now you have to come up with a good way to enhance it enough to be larger than the signals, or at least the tails of the signals that might kill you, or also to overcome and to get some sensitivity for GA gamma gamma. But the nice thing is that if you had a probe and you could enhance the signal enough, then you would be able to, instead of changing the length of the cavity, you change the tuning between the pump and the probe, and you can scan over different axial masses by the tuning to lasers, which more or less the tuning something around. So basically for the axion to be, for the axion mass to change the laser frequency by order one, you need to be electron volt. Electron volt would correspond to frequencies around terahertz. So any axion below electron volt, it's only shifting a little bit. You have to detune a little bit your probe with respect to the pump.
Do you have an axion for
the Yeah. What do you what can you have that shifts this? No, but if you but the vibrations of the so these phonons have the acoustic modes have very thin. Narrow, they are very narrow band, which can, vibration you can have that creates phonons in there. It,
you
this
have
is
many phonons, right?
Yeah, but they won't. So if you have a specific laser and a specific probe and pump laser kinematics, you need to match the modes. There's an overlapping factor that relates. So it's like momentum conservation. There's an overlapping factor that is a sync function and depends on. On the integer of the mode excited by the pump, the integer of the mode excited by the probe, and the mode where the phonon lives. So this is a very specific. If the phonon is somewhere else,
I'm talking about the action. Imagine the action is some vibration.
But then, if you have, so you're telling me, you have a phonon here,
yeah.
And this, right? Yeah, and I'm okay. So I'm here. I'm saying you would have two G naughts, right? And then you would have to overlap to match once you integrate out this photon. There's an overlapping factor between the optical and acoustic modes that kinematics don't give you the freedom to. So you need a very specific phonon for this process to happen. It cannot just be any phonon because this will carry some momentum. You will need some non-relativistic phonon because you don't want to match to spoil the matching condition between the. Basically, you need the acoustic phonon to be the wavelength to be twice the optical photon. If not, a overlap is zero. G naught is zero. You need a perfect overlap between the acoustic and the optical modes, and this gives you a very specific kinematics. The axion doesn't spoil this, and the axion actually.
This one I can do a
sweet
photon absorption.
Right?
I can have like a counterpart.
You can have a counterpart of?
No, counterpropagating. I can have omega k and omega minus k.
Uh-huh.
The two of them only give me a.
In here, you mean? These two guys being.
So I put another one.
Put another one.
I need a photon, right?
Another phonon.
Two phonons with a.
Three phonons and two photons.
But then in here you need, okay, this will be a second, so this would be G naught square as well.
Right, but like that coupling would still be bigger than
the action. Yeah. But are you, okay, I need to check what happens with the kinematics in here because I need a very specific, I need to match, at this point I need to match photons and phonons. In this point I need to match. Always I need to satisfy the A overlap factor. But don't you have to satisfy that each of the vertices? Well, also depends on, because they have this cavity, they have a 100 micrometer cavity and they have it at millikelvin. So the number, the average number of thermal phonons they have is very small. Actually, this would do better for heavier So axions masses that are above the free spectral range, something above micro eV. Well, actually, I was going to bring bad news. I was going to bring now bad news, because the thing we were trying to get the enhancement from phonons and photons, and thinking, I mean, we were talking with experimentalists already, to use a probe laser to scan over this, and also, sorry, where is the, use a probe laser, and on top of that, use also a mechanical drive to drive phonons in a very specific mode, and they told us that they can drive 10 to the 14 phonons with a frequency as narrow as nanohertz, and they are already doing that in their cavities. So then we say, okay, if we can get the enhancement from the phonons and the enhancement from the photons, and you can look at fluctuations on a probe laser, which is already a torch in your cavity, and all the other noises will be less than the laser itself, there's hope to see this. And we were going to write a proposal with them because they are very excited to build a larger cavity. But then, as Asher told us, Jung also realized, because everything is coherent, the same probability that the process happens in one direction happens in the other one. So that's the first time it has happened to me, that I have something on archive that it's not correct. So the calculation is correct, but we forgot the inverse process. So we can only enjoy one of the enhancements. And then the rates go, but we don't touch the QCD line. And then it's complicated, because if we look at the only probe laser.
Sorry, understand.
No. So if you look at the probe laser, fluctuations on the probe laser, the problem is that so you fight against shot noise, which is a square root of n, so you only get a square root of n enhancement. If you look at pumping your cavity with phonons and counting photons, you get the n enhancement from the phonons, but you have to count photons on a cavity where you have three torches. And it's GQuest people say that they can filter tails of lasers that are 10 kilowatt with megahertz filters. But to me, it's still, I mean, we need a lot, we need to discuss with them and see whether this is feasible. And also something I will check now, because Jung Woo was also mentioning, maybe if you can prepare a focus space with phonons, you can still get some N enhancement from this that is not a coherent state. The problem is that if it's a coherent state, it's exactly the same final and initial states. So we will see if we can rescue something, because it's nice that we can. So these are the numbers that these people from Yale that we were working with them, they have right now, and that's what they could do. And if we can enjoy all the enhancements, would be amazing. But the problem is that now we lose a lot on the rate. So really what the question is now, can we save it? And if we can save it, can we look for a specific parameter space where we can see something taking into account all these other possibilities and see what we can say? But it was a bit sad too. I was thinking of the axiom being created. And then initially and final states were different, but the axion is just another coherent field. So it's something so trivial. And why? So it was like we were thinking about this for a while. And yeah, unfortunately, I mean, it's very important for the rate, but it's true that ADMX doesn't have this. Otherwise, they would pump also the probe, right? The final state. Yeah, so I'm going to finish. Sorry for go over time, but basically, I think it's very important to think of what we have right now with all these experiments. Maybe not only specific data detection experiments, like tabletop experiments, are very important, and see other mechanisms. Maybe exploiting quantum mechanical effects, piezo material effects. I love this paper. Any of these possibilities are very important to learn what things about maybe axions, maybe gravitational waves, maybe lighter matter, and we should understand it. And atom interferometers are great, that you can get a coherent enhancement, there's no energy deposition, and they can give you a boost if there's lighter matter. But there are also challenges that it's hard to distinguish if you see a signal from the background, and also you need you are only sensitive to a subcomponent. So now we are trying to understand backgrounds better, any other possible source, and also will be useful for the atom interferometers when they run. And maybe we could also play some constraints in dark matter nuggets, which are also enhanced by a number of dark states, and study the coherence maybe in other sensors, like atomic clocks, which work very similar. And also what happens if we have a network of interferometers, could we reduce the signal-to-noise ratio and get some enhancement in the sensitivity? And the axoptomechanics, now we are trying to understand if we can get any enhancement at all, or what is the best scenario that we can rescue a bit this method of using optomechanics. And we were writing a proposal with Jack Harris and Jörg Spatil, and we will see also with them, because it's once we have some regime, it's important that if we use filters, if we use some refrigerator to cool the helium, we need feedback from them and see what they can do for building it. So, and maybe explore other materials that have larger permittivities or different densities. And that's all. So thank you so much, and sorry for being over time. Yeah, you have another talk now. There's another talk. Ah, you said that there was
I have a meeting.
Ah, okay.
Well, I have to prepare. That's the problem.
And someone told me you have another talk in Korea.
Best time ever.
I know. What?
Very often yesterday.
No. Yeah, it heats up the cavity.
Oh, yeah. You have enough, yeah, but that's a big volume that you have. That's an extra
question. If it's. No. But if you look on, if you are comparing in the noise, because we took the irreducible noise for the, when we were looking at fluctuations on the probe, the number of photons, when you compute the SNR, if you compute the N signal over the square root of N probe, this is huge. So you will hit the cavity, but you are already seeing, looking at fluctuations on a huge torch. So. It will affect the quality factor, the mechanical quality factor, for instance.
Yeah.
But the phonons, so if it can bring the phonons out of resonance, for instance, and this would lower the number of phonons that we can enjoy. But since we can't. They have right now 100 micrometers, but you can't see anything with that. They are going to centimeters, and they were aiming for meters, for 1 meter. With helium. They have millikelvin now.
Eh?
They have millikelvin now with this tiny cavity. The meter is challenging. But then, so imagine it goes to Kelvin temperatures. Still, if you are looking at fluctuations on a probe laser, wouldn't they be larger, the larger source of noise? Because if yeah, but if now we can't enjoy the phonon enhancement, even if the quality factor gets lower, you don't get the quality factor doesn't enter in the rate. Because you just create a phonon, but once you do the Fermi-Golden rule, the amplitudes that the Lorentzians that survive is the convolution of the Boltzmann with, if you lose a probe laser, the width of the laser, a Lorentzian with the width of the laser.
When you lower a quality factor,
goes up.
I don't know what effect that will have.
Yeah, it depends if it overcomes
yeah,
this probe.
It just depends. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. They said they were not worried about that. But we need to check. But this was before. So if now, for instance, if we count photons, this is going to be very relevant. Because it's like, you need to assume an empty cavity. And this is very hard when you have a laser. It's not like a data detection experiment that is background free. I love drawing. So I always take this as an excuse to draw because I love drawing and every time. So I do posters for conferences. So if you are looking for a poster, contact me because that's how I did on my PhD. I went for conferences for free without paying fees because I was designing the posters. So I love to do drawings and physics. That's something I love. So because you need to know a bit about the conference and also to know how to draw to make a nice poster. So you can tell me. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Very nice.
Oh. Thank you. Yeah, I will. I have to look. Thank you, Jungbu, for telling me about. I'll look at these papers and I'll see whether we can get some enhancement and. Yeah, because probably we won't get, will only be one, because if the reverse process, even if you get an n plus one enhancement and the reverse process kills you n, you only get one. So we'll see. If we don't get the n, it's complicated. Yeah, I was so sad. And then Mark said, you know, who never does a mistake, who never does anything. I was like, Mark is so lovely. But yeah, it's very unfortunate. But we'll see. Maybe for still in some regime, there's something useful for ALPS that can be said. And they can build it already. I don't know. We'll see. We'll put a replacement on archive, hopefully take it into account. Either the best scenario, and probably we have to deal with all this. If it's the photon free, so the counting, the background free experiment is going to be very tough. So there we need a lot of input from experimentalists, how they can filter, what's the quality of these filters, and what is the masses that we can. Because the heavier the axiom mass, the farther you are from the pump, which helps, but only helps power law. So you need a lot of suppression. And yeah, we'll see. Thank you so much.